Yeah, well, this was furthest back. This was the territory of the Huron and the Wendat. Wendat is W-E-N-D-A-T, though sometimes it is spelled O-U-E-N-D-A-T. And then the Petun, P-E-T-U-N, and the Seneca. You probably know how to spell because we have a college named after it. And then most recently the Mississaugas of the New Credit, who now live next to the Six Nations Reserve, which is right where I grew up. Yeah. So.
I understood you to say early in your talk that in the Garden of Eden, the sin of eating the apple was about eating out of season.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's something I've never heard before. And I'm just wondering, you also said that we repeat that sin when we eat product from the land that is not grown in season.
Mm-hmm.
So if we follow that through to a logical conclusion, wouldn't we be in a situation where, for example, people who live in the far north would never have fruit and vegetables? And do you really think that's what God intended?
Okay, that's an interesting question. So I'll repeat the question for those of you at the back. Whether if we repeat that first sin by eating out of season, and when we eat out of season, and what that means for the people of the far north, and I mean, there's a couple things to remember here. One is that by taking away the traditional grounds of most of our indigenous peoples, who actually had had cultures that were very tied in with the land. And you're right, the Inuit did not eat fruit or vegetables. But they did have kind of a whole integrated culture that was around what the land did provide there. But by putting people on reserves, by restricting their movements, by a little closer further north, by poisoning the waters, by building hydroelectric dams that flooded their traditional areas, we've actually severed that, the connections that they had with the land, and made them dependent upon importing things like fruit and vegetables. So there's this saying that anthropologists sometimes say, which is that, you know, the cultures, and I would modify it to this, the cultures and the foods that we eat are not the only way you can eat in the world, right? There are all kinds of diverse ways that people interacted with the land and food. So what they are trying to do in the north, so for instance, near Dawson City, there's a reserve that's has a farm program. They are doing more with fruit and vegetables, and they're doing it seasonally. They're finding out, they've got greenhouses that they are using for building that actually don't take power, but that enable them to grow seasonally. So that is happening up there.
That would still be out of season,
in a sense. It is.
I don't think that's what you're intending to say.
That's right. I'm not intending to say that that's, you know, doing that is... That's right.
The same thing as
that's right. Or eating without restraint. I think the thing is, most of the stuff that we eat out of season does violence to the earth in some way. Maybe that's the way to frame it, right? Drying, you know, pemmican is not doing violence to the earth. In fact, drying anything is one of the best ways to store food and most nutritious. Yeah. Well, I think we... there's a somebody in Queen's University who speaks about food banks and says we need to be working towards a culture that doesn't have food banks anymore. Then we will have food justice. And so they're a sign of our brokenness and the injustice that we have them. Yeah. Yes.
At the CNE this year, I bought this whole series of green bins, you know, to put your organic waste in. Now, I have a real issue because outside my apartment building, there's this big locked organic storehouse for people where they can put their greens in, and then it turns it into organic usefulness, where they use it for vegetable gardening and stuff like that. I'm kind of at a loss because I find there's a lot of green bins around here, but where can I take the next step once I have the green bin? And I don't see anybody else with their green bin, you know, being able to take it past that.
You mean sending it somewhere for sending your green bin somewhere for composting?
Yeah. Is there somebody that comes around and picks it up?
Well, the city pick. Are you in an apartment?
Yeah.
Okay, because the city picks it up, but I guess not all apartment buildings have a green bin program. What you need to do is find a friend who has one of the ones that they put by the curb, and or a friend who makes their own compost, and ask them if they'll take it for compost. That's yeah. Now the other end of a whole food thing is, I'll just throw this out there, is where our bodily, what we call waste, our bodily wastes go. We have at our house, sawdust toilets. And we have one flush toilet for people who don't want to use a sawdust toilet, which is just a bucket that you put sawdust into after you use it as a toilet. And then we compost that. And in a lot of, particularly in Asia, people will build very fancy toilets like this to entice people to come and use them because they compost that manure and then their gardens are more fruitful. So this is this is a whole piece that in urban centers could hardly ever happen. I don't know who's going to collect that stuff if we're not flushing it away. But it's just another thing to kind of think about, how to close the circle on kind of what goes into us and what comes out. Now, on that appetizing, it's a good thing we ate already, right? Yes.
Just an aside practical question. Because you said at the beginning that you put your vegetables in the basement.
Yes, I do.
Because what I do, or used to do, particularly with carrots, and I'm wondering what your response is to that, I would, around September, if I would take a lot of carrots up, and then leave the rest of the carrots in the ground all winter, and then take them up around April.
Yeah, you can store things, fruit, vegetables. So a question is about storing carrots in the ground over the winter. Yeah, you can, this is my other hat, not my biblical scholar hat, but when I go to gardening clubs and talk, you can keep them in a root cellar, or you can keep them in the ground actually. And in Toronto, where it doesn't get quite as cold as it does where we live, that works well. Where we live, you have to mulch very heavily so they don't freeze too much. But carrots are best if they've frozen a bit, because then the starch has turned to sweet. I would use bales. I use bales of straw, but that's what's available. Yeah, leaves, big bags of leaves. Just pile a whole bag on top. That'll work too.
And sand?
Yeah. Pardon?
Sand
is what I keep them in the basement. Yeah, yeah.
I'm really curious about this because I do care about sustainability. I'm always curious and eager to learn and move on. What I don't understand is what's so wrong with the barter system. I'm understanding what you're saying, but I'm also saying that if we're going to think of everybody around the world eating well enough and they don't have enough in their own region, then a healthier barter system sounds more reasonable to me than someone just, you know, suffering with fewer fresh vegetables and less fresh meat and less fresh milk.
Oh, I'm with you. A healthy barter system is great. So a bit where I could have gone with part of this, if it had been a longer thing, would be to talk about resilient community, and how do we shape resilient community where things like healthy bartering takes place, but then those communities also being involved with other healthy resilient communities.
Yeah. Yeah. It does take resilience and perseverance before these products ever show up. I just found out this past week that they have fresh milk from Sheldon's Dairy at the St. Lawrence Market. It's a week old. I found out when you go to the store, it's already 2 weeks old maybe on the shelf. But something like that is what I'm talking about. More of that for everybody. But just
right.
To get it out originally is really hard.
Right.
Like eating butter instead of margarine. All these healthy concepts It's not what you're saying. Yes, a resilient community that extends their wealth and negotiates.
So you're talking about educating around these issues, definitely. Yes. Oh, it definitely is. I mean, I teach a whole course on this stuff for a whole semester. So tonight I kind of gave not everything that can happen. Yeah.
All due respect. Yeah. I do believe in fresh for everybody, but, you know, it's just really hard to get it out there. Because sometimes they're hearing what you're saying as well, which is not what I'm saying. But, I mean, we probably agree on a few things. Sustainability for sure. I don't want to dwell on it. I just wanted to bring that up because I'm, you know, really opposed to nobody getting good enough or fresh enough, you know, for everybody wanting to eat out of tins just because that's what you have in your neighborhood. You know, I think there's a happy medium where you can do a lot from local and still share with your neighbor and have them share with you without using too much of the oil reserves or the gas reserves.
Mm-hmm. Well, a great example of sharing in Toronto is not far from the tree. Do people know of this organization? I mean, we used to do this informally with our neighbors. We used to harvest their grapes, make juice, and give them a third back, and we harvested somebody else's pears. When you have little kids, you know where everything is in your neighborhood. But that's an example within the city of that kind of sharing economy happening, too. Yeah, the comment is that the food that you eat that is closer to home is healthier food because the energy of the food is different than food that's imported. I'm summarizing a bit here from further away. And it's not just macrobiotics, but biodynamic farming as well raises this point that we are people. It's interesting. This word Adam from Adama. It's not just any earth or any soil. It's the particular red soil of the land of Palestine. It's that particular soil, which, you know, if we were to delve deeper into that, that says something about we are very much creatures of our place, not just the earth, but our place. And the food of our place is the food that's in sync with who we are. As well. And we know this in terms of body types, right? In terms of people who, you know, Jean is happier probably in the south where it's warmer, though I know she doesn't like to sleep if it's too warm. You know, I mean, I have students who come from Africa and it takes they never get used to the fact because they are so, their bodies are placed, right? And, you know, when I teach in Belize sometimes, and my students in Belize who are there for a couple semesters, they miss the seasons because their bodies are used to seasons. Why would it be that the food of our place wouldn't matter if the climate of our place matters, right? This is I think very important. Yes, the gentleman here.
Maybe this is contentious, but this has been a pretty vegetarian discussion. And, I heard a wonderful disposition by the ethicist Margaret Somerville from Yale about the role that feed animals play in our lives and the importance of our responsibility to make sure we don't waste their sacrifice to us. And I wondered if you could give me your biblical experience of how our relationship with animals is in the Bible.
Okay, our relationship with animals, yeah. Well, so it's clear from Genesis that God's original plan was to hang out in a garden with some naked vegetarians, right? That's how the story begins. That's God's plan A. Plan B was to have a lot of parties with outcasts and sinners. In Genesis 9, meat is given for people to eat. And that's when that kind of starts in the story, even though, so that's right after Moses, right, or sorry, Noah, right after the flood. Though interestingly enough, earlier in the narrative, Cain and Abel, one of them has sheep. So, you know, the story, there's different things going on in how the story is told. And then eating meat sacrificed to idols becomes an issue later on, but the Bible assumes throughout the rest of the story that eating meat is normal. Though it's interesting that there are restraints put upon it. So you can't eat meat with the blood in it. And one author suggests that that's because it takes time to slaughter meat and drain it properly. And that's a restraint. If you don't have time to do that properly, if you're doing so much, you don't have time for that, then that's overconsumptive, right? That's more than you need. And the other limitations around the food laws also suggest some kind of restraint, right? You can eat these meats, but not these. Everything isn't up for consumption by humanity.
That shows that the Bible was not written by Chinese.
That's right. And it wasn't. We know that. But I think the other thing that we know, I mean, you know, this is one thing that Calvin says that I do appeal to, is that we have different ways that God reveals God's self to us, right? There's the Bible, and then there's creation. And we know from creation that animals and domestic animals are an integral part of the fertility of creation. So I was vegetarian for a long time. In fact, my daughter, who's 18, has never, ever eaten meat in her life because I was vegetarian when she was born, and so we never gave her meat. And when we moved to the farm, I started eating meat, but it was too late for her. She'd never had it. But what I've come to realize as we're doing farming, and particularly we're moving into something called permaculture, which is trying to kind of mimic nature and how we farm, is realizing that having animals is healthier for biodiversity and for the land. Than some kinds of growing without animals. So, for instance, and this is sustainably raised animals. I'm not even saying organic, because there is intensive organic agriculture, but it's not good either, I don't think. So we have a small diversified farm. Every summer we have 6 cows that we rotationally graze. We have a couple of pigs that we're trying to use to seal a pond right now. We have some chickens and ducks. And we eat those things. We also name them. So right now we're eating George, who is a very sweet steer, and he's a very nice piece of meat too. Next to us, our neighbor has started renting out a field, and soy is being grown on that field. Now, unfortunately, it's being grown with nicotinoids, which means that when that seed was planted last spring, all the bumblebees were coming back to our property. All the bumblebees in our property that were living near our greenhouse, we have a lot of hay for mulch on the ground there, spoiled hay, and that's what they like to nest in. They looked drunk, and they were dying. These bees were all dying. But that's a huge problem with that soy crop. But even if they weren't spraying that soy crop, even if it was organic, there's no biodiversity left in that field. Because there's no butterflies, there's no insects, there's no habitat, there's no mice, there's no birds nesting there, because it's a monocrop. And that's when it kind of hit me. If I was vegetarian and I was replacing meat with soy, sustainable meat with soy products, I was actually creating these kind of monocrops that don't allow for biodiversity. Whereas where our cows are pastured, there's all kinds of stuff going on in those fields. There's spiders and grasshoppers and bobolinks nested there. And so there's a lot going on. So I think there is a place for sustainably raised meat. Industrial meat is a huge problem, though. And if we're going to do sustainably raised meat, we can't eat meat every night. It can't happen. So that's some kind of restraint we need to practice, right? We don't live in a culture where we live with a lot of restraint. This is something I think we need to learn. That's why Lent is good. If you give something up for Lent, at least you're practicing restraint a little bit. I gave up chocolate this year, and Easter just seems so far away. It's like, isn't it here yet? But yes, Lee.
I just wanted to circle back about access to food in the far north. My parents used to live above the Huyton, and people still live off the land.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like it's a thing of the past, but people still rely totally on fishing and hunting walrus. And now, with climate change, the Inuit are being devastated by this. And they're not able to hunt and fish in the same way. And also, the seas are polluted, and this is also affecting them. But that's kind of one of the untold stories of climate change, is how it's deeply affecting the Inuit. And so there are people that are starving. Last year, there was that news story that came out about the Inuit family, looking through garbage to try to find food. And also, produce and things like that in the far north, it's like $30 for some lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
The prices are very disproportionate. So food justice in Canada is really important. But yeah.
Yeah. And I should... Did people over here hear that? Yeah. I was up at the tar sands a couple of years ago. The Anglican Church does something called Justice Camp. And we were up in Fort Mackay. And this is when I kind of realized that our industrial agriculture really does do violence to the earth. Because, to grow crops with fertilizers and with pesticides, to grow crops on an industrial scale, we need fuel for that. And the tar sands are providing that fuel. And this is wider. I mean, I've just focused on food tonight, but there's like a lot of wider implications for this stuff. And we went up to Fort Mackay, and the people we're talking about, which is surrounded. You can stand in Fort Mackay, which is just north of Fort McMurray, and you can see the hills. On the horizon, you can see the hills of sand that they have created. So, imagine that you're... up in the Kawartha Lakes or Muskoka's, or imagine you're in Algonquin Park and you look up and on the horizon you see this mass and you think, what's that? And it's sand. I mean, one elder said to me, they've changed the sky. I never thought that was possible. But what's happened with the tar sands is everything downstream is completely polluted, and the air quality is completely polluted. So not just are the fish giving cancer to people because the fish are completely polluted, but they can't even harvest the blueberries anymore when they go out for the blueberries. And other berries and nuts in the area, they go out and they say, we can't, first of all, they're dying. The plants are dying, and we can't eat them because they're making us sick. And then, yeah, there's always one store, only one store, and the prices are enormously high. So, and in Fort Chipewyan, further north, the doctor there who started to catalog the cancer that was coming from the tar sands impact, he got shut down by the government. And, the Medical Association of Alberta put him on trial. I mean, it was a terrible thing. Just because he started to document what was happening. If we were eating that industrial stuff, then we are complicit in that going on too. So yeah, I think food justice is definitely something we need to focus on.